And you know, when I was there and I saw how people were looking after this old lady who's sick and lying in bed, and there was just so much metta there. Oh my goodness. So metta isn't something that only belongs to the Buddha. It's not only something that meditators have or monastics have or something like that. It's something that everybody in this room has. Think about that to start with. Every person in this room has metta. Is that true? Do you feel like you have metta all the time? Maybe sometimes have, maybe sometimes not. But we all have it sometimes, yeah? I think if you never have any feelings of metta or something, that's probably what we call like a psychopath or something like that. You probably end up in jail as a serial killer or something. We all have the metta. And it's very, very important to understand that the Buddha was just a man. He's just a human being. And where he begins, what he is dealing with, the problems that he's dealing with and the practices that he did is not all that different from where you are at. And so sometimes when we're thinking about the Buddha and we're thinking about him as a spiritual teacher, we get this idea that he's so kind of exalted, he's so perfect, he's so amazing in so many ways, that we forget that actually he's just a person. And all of those amazing qualities that he had started out as just ordinary everyday things. And he started out just like you, just like me, sometimes feeling metta, sometimes not, sometimes getting angry, sometimes not, sometimes being smart, sometimes being stupid. Yeah. And learning little bit by little bit by little bit. Yeah. So the difference between us and the Buddha is not the difference in kind, right? Buddha wasn't a different kind of being. It's not a difference in nature. It's just a difference in a stage of development or a stage of evolution. So all of those things that we're still struggling with are things that the Buddha had already dealt with. So that's all. That's really the only difference. And when the Buddha was asked about, you know, what's the difference between yourself and the other disciples who are enlightened, he would say, well, the only real difference is that I was the one who discovered the path and they're following along with the path afterwards. So when we see how the Buddha acted and behaved, then it can give us some examples for how we can live and how we can also try to develop metta. So of course I could, we could describe everything in the life of the Buddha and talk about how it's a manifestation of metta. But I'll just try to pick out a few examples and a few stories that give some different sides for how the Buddha lived and how he manifested metta in his life. The Buddha wasn't what you would call an emotionally demonstrative man. Okay, so he wouldn't run up and give you a hug. Or at least doesn't say that in the suttas as far as I know. Okay, and so the way he expresses things and the way that he did things was quite subtle and quite very refined. And so we find his metta, his loving kindness, is manifested through ordinary, simple things that are practiced every day. So, of course, the Buddha, most obvious way we can look at the Buddha's practice of loving kindness is through meditation. And the Brahma Viharas, we call the four Brahma Viharas. These are little bodhisattvas come to help us to practice metta. Now it's quiet. Wow. So, through practice of meditation, and this is part of his Buddha's regular meditation practice, right, was to do loving kindness and the other Brahma Viharas as a daily practice. Okay, so that means he would go into these meditations, the very profound meditations, and in that state of meditation, is what we call immeasurable. And what immeasurable means is that there's no difference. You know, the Buddha would say, like, sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhitātā, yeah? May all beings be happy. That means there's no difference between any being. This is the first thing to bear in mind. All beings. And even though it's, I think, very true to say that the ideal of loving kindness is certainly not a Buddhist ideal as such, we find it in all religions. Absolutely. And, you know, it was around before the Buddha was around. We find it in some of the ancient Chinese philosophers. We find it talked about in some of the Greek philosophers, Christianity, Islam, all the different religions and so on, they talk about it. But I think the place where we found it taught the most clearly and consistently and most centrally, at least the earliest place we find it like that, is in the Buddhist scriptures. It's very uncluttered, very straightforward. And so this idea that we have loving kindness for all, regardless, is fundamental to the Buddha's notion of loving kindness. So one of the results from this, one of the consequences of this, is that we shouldn't discriminate. Okay? And this is fundamental to the Buddha's practice of loving kindness. Now, discrimination is something that we find very, very widespread in human societies, isn't it? Yeah, people always seem to find somebody to treat as other, to treat as lesser. Yeah, maybe it's based on your skin color, maybe it's based on your race, your religion, your language. Maybe the men think the women are lesser, or the women think the men are lesser, or could be all kinds of things based on age, based on disabilities and illness. And we find in most societies that this kind of thing happens. Now, to some extent, we can understand that at certain times and places that there might be some purpose to this, some justification for it. You know, for example, if you're living like in a very tribal society, you know, you obviously have to have strong bonds with the members of your own tribe, and you have to defend it if you're being attacked from outside. So those kinds of things can be understandable. But I think in the world that we live today, that these kinds of discrimination have long outlived any usefulness that they might once have had. And instead they've become very, very destructive. Now, even though each society has these kinds of discrimination, they will manifest in different ways. And there'll be different issues that will come up from different times and places. So, for example, in the Buddha's day, one of the most pressing issues as far as discrimination was about the caste system. Okay? And so we have the Brahmin caste who asserted that they were supreme. And the sort of Brahmins came along and made this scheme that put them at the top and then said all the other castes were less. And then the other castes came along and said, hey, you didn't ask about this. And so this idea that you're kind of fixed in these categories and that's how you are for life. And if you're in one of the high castes, that meant you're intrinsically superior. Yeah. You're intrinsically superior because you happen to get born in the Brahmin caste. And so the Buddha came along and he just rejected this out of hand. And it's one of the first teachings that we find in the biography of the Buddha after he became enlightened. And he just said, no. He said, a person's worth is due to what they do. What choices do they make? How do they live? This is what we call karma. Right? Karma is how you live. What kind of person are you? That's how we distinguish between people, by their actions, not by their caste or anything else. And so this, I think, is a very important message, a very powerful central message in the Buddha's teachings. It flows directly from the teachings on loving kindness, and it manifests in the social realm. Okay, so it manifests in how we relate to and how we treat other people. And so we see that the Buddha didn't just talk about this, but that's how he lived. When anybody came to join the Sangha, when anyone came to become a monk or a nun, he would never discriminate on the basis of caste or anything else. Okay. This is quite radical. You have to understand, this is a very, very revolutionary way of being in ancient India at that time. And unfortunately, that's not even today. We find in Buddhism that people don't always keep that. For example, in Sri Lanka, some of the Nikayas will only accept people from the right caste. Yeah, so the ordination in some of the Nikayas in Sri Lanka is actually based on caste. I was shocked when I heard that. Yeah, how can they do this? So directly against everything the Buddha taught. Yeah, so it's not all of the Nikayas in Sri Lanka. Some of them will reject that, and that's good of them to do that. But I find this thing so strange. I can't comprehend it. So these things always have a tendency to come back in, to creep back in. And we've seen in our lifetime, I think we've seen major shifts in our awareness around these things. And I think on the whole, I think we're improving. I look at my situation in Australia, and I think that Australia has a lot of things that we need to improve on. Yeah, the treatment of the Aboriginals, for example, I think is very, very problematic. It's not at all a simple problem. It's a very complex problem. But there's some very ingrained prejudices and so on. I think there's many things that need to be done, and I'm not proud of our record as Australians. However, things have at least got better. Yeah, Aboriginals now have the vote, which in the past they didn't. They now have some land rights in some different situations. In the past, they didn't. And if you look at the attitudes of some of the colonials in the 19th century, then they would do things like hunt Aborigines for sport. Yeah, quite terrible. Not everyone, obviously, but some people would do that. Yeah, so nobody does that anymore. We've got better. At least to some degree. Not everything's got better. Not everything's perfect. But something has got better. I think there's something very important going on here. And what's going on is we're moving towards a real acceptance of the Buddha's ethics and the Buddha's metta of having loving kindness for all sentient beings, regardless. Yeah, another aspect is discrimination against women. And we've seen, again, a big shift in the last century. Yeah, in the beginning of the century, then women wouldn't have the vote, wouldn't have basic rights to equality of income and so on. And so now most of those basic rights, education and so on, in most developed or developing countries, and women have all those rights. Of course, there's still a lot of inequality. There's still a lot of things like domestic violence and rape and these kinds of things, which are very important issues that need to be discussed and need to be overcome. But I think there's been some improvement, and not just a little. I think there's a very important improvement. And there's still many things to go. In Australia, you may be aware we've been having discussions in the last couple of years on same-sex marriages. Okay, and so this is an area of discrimination which is sort of coming into focus in this period of time. And we've seen a big shift in the last 10 years from a sort of majority opposition to a majority favouring. And I think this is another area where, as a Buddhist community, we need to think about and to reflect about how accepting and how loving that we can be for people. And I'm very conscious that, you know, people who have a different sexuality, different gender orientations, how much suffering there is in that. And when a couple of years ago, I attended they're having a Senate inquiry in Australia into this, which I was invited to attend along with some of the leaders of the bishops and the Catholics and Anglicans, and these people were there. And what really struck me and what I said was at the meeting was I hadn't heard any words of compassion. Yeah. All of these people were saying, you know, it's about the intrinsic order of society and it's about this and about that. And not a single person had said anything about actually acknowledging the suffering that gay people have, yeah, that transgender people have. They don't fit in. And that's us, right? We've got a big group of people here. There are gay people here. There are lesbians here. There are people who probably, I don't know, transgender or something like that. I won't ask you to put up your hands. But that's you. Yeah? Yeah? It's not the other. Yeah? And so what are you going to say? You know, are you going to say to, you know, you're going to find rejection and discrimination through your whole life. You're going to be struggling with your family, maybe your friends, at your work, everything that you do, you go through your life. That's going to be an issue that you're going to be dealing with, and it's going to be uncomfortable and it's difficult and it's suffering. And then when you come to spiritual life, are you going to meet even more discrimination in a spiritual community from people, even the people who supposedly are dedicated to loving kindness and compassion? Are they, even those people, are they going to discriminate you even more? Yeah? That's the question we need to ask. And so I think we need to make Buddhism a refuge and a support for people. So I was asked about this question when I was in Indonesia a little while ago, and they said, you know, what do we do? I said, come to Australia and get married in Australia. But even in Australia, it's still very much debated. Actually, they had a vote, and the reason why I'm talking about it now, I was reminded a couple of days ago there was a vote in the Parliament, and they defeated the marriage equality bill by just one vote in the New South Wales Parliament, which is very, very disappointing. And but you know, I'm confident that as time goes on, that gradually this will overcome this, and in 10 years or 20 years' time, we'll look back and it'll just seem ridiculous. All these predictions that society is going to end and all of these kind of things, what a load of rubbish. It will go, you know, it'll be just like, you know, it's actually very interesting to study a bit of history. And when you look at history, you find exactly the same kinds of arguments that people brought up when they said, oh, we should pay women the same as we pay men, right? And then all the same arguments, oh, the family will be ended and all the women won't be in the work, looking after the children, and society is going to collapse and fall apart if you give them equal pay. Yeah. So we don't have to be afraid. Yeah. All these things just come from loving kindness, and we don't have to be afraid of what the consequences are. Loving people more is not going to lead to the ending of society. Society and damage and harm, all of those things happen because of the lack of love and the lack of acceptance. So as we go on into the future, these issues won't go away, right? We're going to have to keep on facing them in different spheres, all right? So what about, for example, what about aliens? Right? And they come down, and we're going to have to. Do we have loving kindness for aliens? What about if you want to marry one? I know that you're green and you've got tentacles, but I just love you anyway. Right? So, from a Buddhist point of view, oh, we don't care, that's all right. Yeah, that's okay. So these things will be changing. They're always changing, and there's always new challenges. And so we have to always come back to those basic principles of loving kindness that we always have. Now, when we look at how the Buddha lived and so on, he, as you know, the Buddha after his practice, he became enlightened and then began to teach. He would always, to me, one of the most overwhelming things about when looking at the Buddha and how he dealt with people, how he helped them and taught them, was about how even-minded he was with everybody. Yeah? It's not something that's obvious. Yeah? It's a very subtle quality. And it only sort of comes out when you read many of the suttas and really contemplate them, and you see how skillful the Buddha is to be in so many different situations, people coming and challenging him and arguing with him and all these things. It's not as if, you know, just because he was the Buddha that everybody did what he said, right? That's not the case at all. Right? People would disagree with him, even his monks would disagree with him. And so the Buddha never get upset. One good example was Meghya. One of my favorite suttas, the Meghya Sutta, and one of the Buddha's attendants early in his career was a monk called Meghya. And they were walking along together, and they went past a certain mango grove, and Meghya said, "Oh, that looks like a nice place for meditation." And he asked the Buddha, he said, "I just want to go to that grove and spend a few days there meditating." And the Buddha said, "Oh, no, you better stay here with me." And he said, "No, I really want to go off and do some meditation." And the Buddha said, "I really think it's better if you stay with me." And he said, no, "I really want to go off and do that meditation." And the Buddha said, "Well, I really think it's better if you stay with me, but, you know, if you talk about going and doing some meditation, who am I to stand in your way?" And so he did. He went off and sat in that mango grove to do his meditation. And it was complete rubbish. He had a terrible time. His mind's overwhelmed with defilements. He's sitting in there and his mind's completely lost and completely crazy. He came back to see the Buddha. I mean, think about if that was you, you know, the overwhelming temptation to say, "Told you so," right? Right? How hard it would be to not say, "I told you so," in that circumstance. But the Buddha didn't say that, you know? Came back, and the Buddha said, "Oh, that's how it is when the mind is not ready. Yeah, when the mind is not ready for meditation, then there are these things you need to look to help to support and develop it to make it ready for meditation." And then he taught these very beautiful teachings about Kalyanamitta, yeah, having good spiritual friends, and how that's very supportive, and so on. And so he then led him through and showing how you develop. So again, that's a great example of the Buddha's metta. He's not telling him off. He's not saying you're naughty. He's not saying you should have obeyed me. Okay? He's saying, "Well, you know, this is what I recommend. If you do something different, that's okay. But this is what happens, and this is why it's happened, and this is how to stop it happening again in the future." This is something that I've found myself when dealing with monks and living in the monks' communities. And people sometimes have this strange idea that living in a monastery is a place where you can tell people what to do. They somehow seem to think that an abbot's job is to tell monks what to do. I'm like, no, that's not my job. It's very interesting. If you think about monastic communities and so on, and there seems to be a very kind of hierarchical and so on. But actually, it's very interesting. If you know the Vinaya gives no power of command to any monk. Right? No power of command. Now, you think about in your business or something like that, right? You usually have like these levels of hierarchy and so on, and then the person at the top gets to boss around the people underneath them, and the person who's above them gets to boss them around. And basically what you do is you get to internalize all your emotional frustrations, so you get bossed around, and then you relieve the tension by bossing around the people under you, and that's how organizations function. But in the Sangha, actually, at least in the Sangha as the Buddha laid it down and ran it, that doesn't happen at all. No monk has the power to order another monk to do anything at all. It's interesting, isn't it? Right? or to order a nun to do anything at all, for that matter. Yeah? Have no power of command, no matter how senior you are. Yeah? No matter how senior, no matter whether you're enlightened or anything like that. And you can see in that example, even the Buddha, the monks would say they'd go off and do something different, and there's no comeback, there's no punishment or anything like that. So the Buddhist Sangha is not based on that conception of obedience in that way, but it's based on a conception of respect, of listening, of learning and reflection. And on consensus, what does have power in the Sangha is the Sangha. Okay, so if the Sangha makes a decision, everybody working together, then we can expect that people will obey that. Yeah, but only because you've taken part, you've given your agreement. Yeah, but I can't go into a monastery and then start ordering people around. So once more, this is that expression of love, that love that's expressed in a sense of respect for every person in the community. This is very, very important. You think about that, right? You think about how communities run, how communities happen. Now, if you say in the Sangha, it would be very easy for the Buddha to just say, look, just do what I say, right? Most people probably would have been happy with that most of the time. And it probably would have worked out okay most of the time, right? But the Buddha didn't say that. Right from the beginning, he started to give power and respect to the Sangha to make their decisions. Okay? Right from we see that from the beginning of the Vinaya. The first chapter in the Vinaya is talking about how the Buddha gave the monks the power to give ordination. Okay? So that's very, very important. That means the control of who can be in and who's out of the Sangha. And he was saying to the monks, you can do that. Yeah? I don't have to be involved. Yeah? You have the responsibility. Again, this is that expression of metta, that expression of trust. Yeah? Oh, you can make that decision. Not controlling things. Yeah. And this to me is one of the great strengths of the Buddha's teachings. So of course there's some times when the Buddha became challenged in his practice of metta. Well, when I say it, I don't know if he became challenged, but he certainly... There certainly were times when people tried to make it hard for him, like, you know, trying to kill him and stuff. So you think about that. So one of the incidents that's quite remarkable is when Devadatta came up to him. And now this time Devadatta, as you well know, was the Buddha's cousin, and he rebelled against the Buddha and did all of these terrible things, including hiring a bunch of assassins to come and kill the Buddha. That's pretty bad, isn't it? After he failed to kill him himself, he hired all these assassins to come and kill them. Of course, the Buddha just converted the assassins, and they all... Right? But... And so after doing all this stuff, Devadatta comes up to the Buddha and says, oh, Buddha, you're getting old. You should retire and give the Sangha to me. I'll look after the Sangha. Now that might sound a bit kind of outrageous, a bit narcissistic really, isn't it? Devadatta's thinking, oh, I'm going to come and look after the Sangha. Actually, when I was abbot of Santi, I had several people come up and say the same thing to me. It's true. No one actually tried to assassinate me. Although I think a few people were thinking about it. But, certainly I had some people come up and offer to, you know, relieve me of my responsibilities and run the monastery and so on. Yeah, usually this is people who'd only ever lived in a monastery for about 2 weeks or something. And, one of the women who came and stayed in the monastery, this young woman who'd only been, she stayed with us for about 2 weeks or something like that, and she came up and she said, if you gave me full control of the monastery, I'd be able to solve all the monastery's problems in 1 week. Really? I said, oh, that's very nice. Some people really think like that. Crazy. Anyway, so Devadatta comes up to the Buddha and says, "I'm, you know, if you only give me control of the monastery, then everything will be fine." And so the Buddha said, Well, I wouldn't even give the Sangha to control of the Sangha to Sariputta and Moggallana, much less to a piece of spit like you. How could the Buddha say that? That's outrageous. Okay, first of all, yeah, I mean, okay, there was a pretty big provocation, right? I mean, Devadatta's trying to kill him and stuff and then trying to take it over, but still, Devadatta was pretty upset. Yeah, so was that the Buddha getting angry? Sorry? In a way. In what way? I know that there are quite a few people, the people in the secular Buddhist movement sort of argue that this shows the Buddha still had anger. Yeah? But I mean, one thing that I know because of, you know, when you do, close textual studies, you can't be too insistent on anything like this, you know, any of the details. You know, we know that the Buddha said countless times that he'd overcome greed, hatred and delusion. Yeah, and so we see one passage where looks like, I don't know, it looks like maybe someone who's acting out of anger, but maybe not also. We can't come to any real conclusion about what someone's mental state is when they say it, and we don't even know exactly really what he said and exactly what went on and so forth. But anyway, it certainly is a very memorable passage. And Devadatta, I'm pretty sure Devadatta had anger after that. And anyway, so, but the overwhelming thing we find is the Buddha's response out of loving kindness. And this is not just those big things and not just those amazing meditations and things like that, but we also find lots and lots of little stories. One story that I like is a good example of the Buddha's metta. It's actually not from the early suttas, but this is a story from a book called the Ashokavadana, and it concerns a monk called Upagupta. And this is Upagupta went. He was born about 100, or lived about 150 years after the Buddha, and 150 years, yeah, maybe 100 years or so after the Buddha died, and he, the only thing that he regretted was that he was never able to actually see the Buddha. And he heard a story that there was one person still alive at his time who had actually seen the Buddha. Yeah? And that was this very, very old nun, this very old bhikkhuni, who was more than 100 years old, and she'd seen the Buddha when she was a young girl. And so he wanted to go and see this nun. That's a very, very funny story, very good story. Upagupta goes to visit this nun in her room, and she's very old. When he opens the door, he opens the door as mindfully as he can, but next to the door was a bowl full of sesame oil. And he couldn't help it, as carefully as he tried to open the door, he couldn't help but knocking the bowl of sesame oil and spilling it down the side. Anyway, he just kind of apologized and wiped it up, and then sat with the nun and was talking with her and said, you know, I heard that you had been alive in the time of the Buddha. And she said, yes, that's true. And he said, did you meet the Buddha? And she said, yes, I did, when I was a very young girl. I only met him one time. And I was very young, and what happened? And Upagupta said, well, what happened? What went on? And she said, well, the Buddha came for alms round to our house. And so when we heard that the Buddha was walking down the street, imagine that, right? Imagine that you were in your home or your workplace or something like that, and then you hear, oh, the Buddha's walking down the street, he's coming for alms round. Imagine how excited you'd be. Oh, everyone would be running around. Oh, we get some food, we get it together, we come offer. Yeah. That would be so amazing. And so he's walking down, and then he came to our house, and we invited him into the house, and we offered him some alms. And then when I bowed down to him, I had like a hair clip, and my hair clip fell out and fell under a chair. Because I was only a little girl, I was really upset that I'd lost my hair clip. And the Buddha said, oh, your hair clip is under the chair there. So I got it out. So this is what this nun said. I always remember the Buddha. He was so kind. He showed me where my hair clip was. Isn't that a lovely story? I really like that. And Upagupta said, oh, sadhu, sadhu, that's so wonderful. And he said, but you know, what was it like? You know, what were the monks in those days like, you know? And this nun said, "Oh, the monks in those days were so much better than they are today. They're all really well practicing and so on." She said, "You know, I tell you how much better monks were in those days. Yeah, you see, you're." She said to Upagupta, "You know, you're one of the most highly regarded monks in the whole of the land. You know, everyone regards you as this great arahant and your great teacher, and so on." She said, "But even in the Buddha's day, we had the monks who were called the group of six monks. Yeah." And the group of six monks were the worst monks in the whole Sangha. They were really bad. And they did everything wrong. And most of the rules in the Vinaya are all laid down because of the group of six monks. Right? Because they were all doing naughty things all the time. But she said, even those monks, even the group of six monks, were mindful enough that they didn't spill my oil when they came into my room. So that's the Buddha's metta, yeah? The very big things as well, but also even just the very little things. And then, of course, another story of the Buddha's metta was when he found the sick monk. And again, this is a very famous story. This is from the Vinaya, where he's walking around the monastery. And there was a monk lying sick in bed. And, you know, just he soiled his bed and all of these things. And the Buddha asked the monks, "What's going on with this monk? Is anybody looking after him?" And they said, "Oh, he's no use to us." Hopefully that response doesn't represent the Sangha as a whole at that time. Hopefully it just represented those few monks. But anyway, they said, "He's no good for us, so we just don't do anything. He never helped us, so why should we help him?" And so the Buddha said, "That's not right, monks." He said, "You should look after the sick." And so he went, called Venerable Ananda, and they lifted that monk and they moved him and they cleaned him and they bathed him and cleaned all his bedding and so on. And just looked after him as the role of the carer and a nurse. Again, this is only something that's very small. It's an everyday thing. Yeah? It happens in hospitals and in homes every day. So many thousands of people do that every day. And yet it's such a beautiful gesture, such a beautiful kindness. And so the Buddha said to the monks, "You should always look after somebody who's sick. Anybody who looks after the sick, anyone who looks after me should look after the sick." And so when we have that attitude of metta and loving kindness, there's never a feeling of wanting to get anything out of it. This is the essence of loving kindness. You know, and you can see in that response by the monks is sort of getting to the point of what's the difference between loving kindness and things that are based on selfishness. Yeah, they were being selfish. They're saying, "We don't get anything out of it, so why should we do it?" Right? And that's the point. That's the essence, the difference of loving kindness. Loving kindness, you never expect to get anything back. Yeah, it's just giving. That's it. Yeah? Never expecting anything back. And you know, it's very, I think, very telling or very characteristic in our relationships that usually our relationships are kind of mixed, are kind of complex. Yeah? So we have people in our family or people that we love, and usually we kind of love them with there's some metta and kindness and so on there, but there's also a kind of feeling of wanting to get something back from them. "I love you because you make me feel good." Right? "I love you because you make me feel good. And you're going to say nice things to me and get me nice things and treat me nicely and all of those things, and therefore I'm going to love you." Yeah? What would happen if that person stopped doing those things? Yeah? And that's the real metta. The real metta is you don't even ask. It doesn't even cross your mind. You just love anyway. And so the Buddha was never had this favoritism, never choosing one over the other, it's just not a trace of that, not a feel of that anywhere in anything the Buddha did. Anybody who would come to him, he would treat with the same kindness and fairness. So this is a great example. One of the great things that we can learn from reading the suttas and seeing the Buddha's example of how he would treat with kindness and fairness everybody, even those people who came up to him being angry, being aggressive and so on, and just to deal with them always in that same way. So anyway, this is my talk for this morning on the Buddha's metta. And any questions or comments, or if you've heard any good jokes lately, you can let me know. If you tell me any good ones, I'll tell Ajahn Brahm when I get back to Perth. So.
Okay, we shall open for questions. Before that, shall we thank Ajahn for a very inspiring talk? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, I think it's going to be a bit challenging because a lot of people here, but whoever have any question or comment, you can raise your hand, then I will pass around the mic to you.
Yeah, thank you, Ajahn, for the talk. I just want to focus a bit on your earlier part of the talk about the gay community, how they suffer. Now, so there's some moral judgment there that there's nothing wrong with being gay. Now, there's the other part of this sexual misconduct, where in Singapore recently there was a company trying to set up a website for infidelity, meaning that if you want to be ungrateful, you can go to this site. And then the government banned it. So my point is that they are saying that they didn't invent sexual misconduct. So why should you ban it? You know, infidelity is not a crime in Singapore. So my point is that the people who want to have sexual misconduct are also suffering. So can we have some compassion for them versus the gay? You know? So this is my point.
Especially if you're the partner, then you should have a lot of compassion. Yeah? If your husband or your wife goes out and sleeps with somebody else, you should have a lot of compassion for them.
So what I'm saying is that's also not wrong, but in the Buddhist context, sexual misconduct is wrong, but gay is not wrong.
That's right, yeah. So yeah, just to clarify that, I mean, I think that's a good point. Essentially how sexual misconduct is defined in Buddhism is it's basically about causing harm. So it's any kind of sexual conduct which causes harm, usually through betrayal, whether it's adultery or whatever. It could be through, you know, obviously more drastic cases like rape or paedophilia and so on are also included. But the main issue is about just whether it's a kind of behaviour which is causing harm. Now, of course, as sexuality is a very powerful force in the human mind, it's not possible to sort of draw hard and fast lines around this. Yeah? For example, you know, you can say something like, well, paedophilia, you can say, well, this is always wrong. But then you might say something like, say, promiscuity. Okay, is a bit harder to define, right? How many partners does that mean? How often does it mean? What kind of behaviours does it encompass? Obviously, extreme cases in promiscuity might be harmful, but then lesser cases maybe not so much. So it's a bit hard to define some things, but that's the basic idea. And we know from the Buddhist scriptures and that homosexuality was quite well known in the time of the Buddha. The Vinaya and so on discuss homosexual acts quite frequently and without any shame or anything about it. It's not kind of hidden away. There's no kind of euphemisms. Interesting, actually, one of the projects I'm doing at the moment, we're revising the English translation of the Pali Vinaya. And this is now a 60-year-old translation, and Venerable Brahmali is actually doing the main work on that. One of the main things we have to do is to retranslate a lot of these passages in the Vinaya, which the English translators wouldn't even translate, right? Because it talks about things like homosexuality and so on, and they were like, oh, no, this is not really fit for a modern audience. So they just tried to hide it away. And you can see in the Buddhist texts, these things are just talked about very frankly and very openly. It's not regarded as being a big deal. For example, you have a case where Sariputta had two boys who were novices, who were his attendants, and then they messed around together. And the Buddha said, well, look, you know, you shouldn't have two attendants. That's all, right? Don't have two attendants. And so, and of course, in a monastic community, it was a celibate community, obviously, so any kind of sexual misconduct, any kind of sexual conduct is out of order. So, but there's no big deal about it, right? It's just what people do. And so that kind of situation came up, you know, quite frequently, and it's always discussed in this very, very straightforward and very matter-of-fact manner.
So we know the meditators got the sticker, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No meditator, no sticker.
Yeah.
Can you count how many?
Even more drastic things like sex change is another one which is talked about in a very matter-of-fact way in the Vinaya. Quite astonishing, really, because these days we get so caught up about these things and so many discussions about it and everything. And so you have in the Vinaya this case where this monk woke up in the morning and he's like, oh my God, I've turned into a woman. So he goes to the Buddha and says, what do I do? And the Buddha says, well, you go over to the bikini quarters. Very straightforward. He's like, oh, okay. That's it. There's no kind of big deal about it. There's no kind of, you know, it's like, oh, you can be turned into a woman overnight. Oh, well, yeah, that's it. It happens, you know. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether that happened, you know, as actual historical fact. Did that happen or not? Actually, there are cases, usually around puberty. I think there were some tribes in Africa where they did actually have spontaneous sex changes. So it's certainly not impossible, but whether that happened or not, I don't know. But the main point is that's how the Vinaya treats it, right? They were quite conscious of it. I suspect that some of these things, it's got more to do with somebody asking questions in the back of the class in the Vinaya lessons, you know? And that the Ajahn's up there teaching about ordination and blah, blah, blah. And then the slightly difficult student at the back of the class puts up his hand and says, but Ajahn, what happens if you wake up and you become a woman overnight? That's the kind of question that we ask in the Vinaya classes. So. All right, so another question.
Yes, good morning, Ajahn. Thank you for our most amusing morning. My question is this. How do we practice metta when the livelihood, the values of the society, the family, the survival of the family and the country are compromised and threatened? Thanks.
Well, can I get you to narrow it? That's a very kind of big scope. Can I get you to narrow it down a little bit for me?
Yes. How can we practice metta if our own survival is threatened?
Okay, if our own survival is threatened. Okay. Well, there could be many different cases where that occurs. A very drastic case might be if you're caught in some disaster, something like that, you know, and you, what do you do? Do you go out and try to grab the last case of food and try to keep it for yourself, or do you share? I was talking about this actually with some people the other day. Apparently studies have shown that basically people who share survive better. Right? So if all you want to do is survive, you share. Yeah? And the people who hold on to things, they don't tend to survive. Yeah? It might seem to be the opposite, but it's not. Why? Obviously, if you have metta, your kindness, people will appreciate that and you work together. And people who work together are always going to be stronger than people who are individuals. It's as simple as that. Yeah? So in all of those situations, yes, it can be very difficult. I mean, if you look at the way that the Buddha handled these things is another reason why, you know, studying the suttas in detail can be very useful, because you see that almost always there's cases where the Buddha came up to similar kinds of challenges, and he always had very skillful ways of dealing with it. For example, like sometimes there might be some criticism of the Buddha or the Sangha. People might go around and saying bad things about them. And so the Buddha would always tell the monks, look, don't overreact, you know. If people say something, then you can just say, look, that's not true. But, you know, there's no need to sort of make a big deal about it. It will die down by itself. Yeah? And so sometimes we tend to overreact with these things. So the important thing is if you're in that situation where you feel threatened and you feel there's a conflict, is first of all you look for the harmony and the unity, that, which is where the strength will come from. Remember in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when King Ajatasattu's minister asked him for military advice on invading a foreign country. It's kind of weird, but that's what he did. I want to start a war. Go and ask the Buddha what he says. Well, I mean, you have to admit, I mean, Ajata Sattu cops a bit of flack in Buddhist circles, but, I mean, it actually shows a sign. I mean, he couldn't have anticipated that the Buddha, he wasn't thinking the Buddha's going to say to him, you know, go and do it, it's going to be great, right? I'm sure that's not what he expected to hear. So, you know, he's getting opinion from a different voice, somebody who he knows is not going to be necessarily in favour of war, right? So actually, it's quite canny that he did that. Yeah, he's going out and looking for advice from a different source. Anyway, so the Buddha said, as long as the Vajjayans remain in harmony, then you won't be able to destroy them. Yeah. So again, this is very, very important to remember. If there's any kind of threat, the first thing you look for is that unity and harmony within yourself or within your community. That's where the strength. That's where the greatest resistance will come from. In terms of responding to aggression and so on, I think a number of important principles. One first important principle is to, as much as possible, stick with the facts. Okay, don't get involved in anything personal. Yeah? Even if people are making personal criticisms, don't respond in kind. Okay, it just makes you look bad. Right, and this turns it into a slinging match. Yeah, if you want to do that kind of thing, go into politics, or at least go into Australian politics. I don't know about Singapore politics, but certainly Australian politics. That's what most of it consists of. So, you just stick with the facts. This is what happened, right? Not saying you're right or you're wrong or I'm right or you're wrong, all this kind of stuff. This is what happened, this is what the facts are. And so at least you've got a starting point, right? At least you can agree about what the facts were. That's not going to solve your problems, but it does give you somewhere to start. And the second thing to do is in some way to figure out where the other person is suffering, right? Where they're coming from, why they're suffering, what it is that they need. And there was a wonderful documentary came out many years ago called The Fog of War by Robert McNamara. I don't know if you've seen it, but if you haven't seen it, do try to get hold of it and have a look at it. It's very, very insightful. Robert McNamara was the American Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War and earlier than that in some of the crises. And he had some very, very good things to say after many years of reflecting on these things. And he said that he was talking about the Cuban crisis, and he said that, you know, there was a very, very, they came very, very close to nuclear war at that time. We don't really appreciate how close. They came extremely close to nuclear war, even closer than the Americans thought at the time. And he was talking many years later with the Cuban general. McNamara said to him, you know, you have to realize, you know, we were really strong at that time, but we were really afraid that you would get hold of nuclear missiles and shoot them at America, and that you'd actually give the order to bomb America. And the general said to him, you still don't get it. We had already done that. We had already prepared to shoot the nuclear missiles at America, right? That wasn't a theory. We had already done that, and you would have done the same thing if you were in our place. Right? That's how close it came, and it only turned back because the only reason that shifted was because there was a American diplomat in Washington at the time who had previously been in Moscow many years earlier, and had personally known Khrushchev, who later on went to become the head of the Soviets. And because he knew Khrushchev, he knew his personality, and he knew how he could retain power. And he said to President Kennedy, he said, look, Khrushchev doesn't want to start a war, okay? He's not a warmonger, he's not belligerent, right? But if he loses face with the Russians, then he won't be able to keep his job, and somebody worse will take over. Right? Right? So you have to give him a way that he is going to be able to look like he wins from the Russian point of view. Yeah? And if you can do that by understanding who he is, how he is, and so on, then we can avert a terrible situation. And so that's how they did it, and that's how they managed to reach a diplomatic solution to what could have been a very, very terrible thing. So that's another, I think, really important thing to start to ask is how does that other people feeling? Why are they being so aggressive? What is it that they want? And very often when we start to understand that, we can start to do something meaningful to change the situation. Okay, so next one. Yeah.
This is the last question. Yeah.
Possible to have a big ego and still have a metta, much metta in that person?
Is it possible for somebody to have a big ego and metta? Well, the person who has the big ego would think it was possible. Right? So from their point of view, it's all fine. Yeah. Is it possible for someone to have a big ego and lots of metta? I think to some degree, yes, but there'll come a point where it'll be limited. Yeah, there'll come a point where you know, obviously selfishness is just. I mean, if somebody has a big ego or someone who's very narcissistic will tend to. They can have metta for other people as long as those other people acknowledge their place in the universe, which is of course at the centre of it. Right? Yeah. Yes, yeah, they'll still want to have the name. Yeah. I certainly think that giving up that sense of selfishness around things is a very, very powerful part of developing loving kindness. And it's one of the things that actually developing loving kindness will help to erode that sense of narcissism and sense of egoism gradually, little bit by little bit, because the whole point of loving kindness is to see the connection, the point of similarity between oneself and others. Yeah, and that, of course, completely undermines the whole basis of the egoism.
Okay, Ajahn. Would you like to say something about Sutra here? Sutra Central?
Sutra Central?
Yeah? Could you say something, maybe?
Something?
Yeah, very quick one.
Sorry.
Because we've got a donation box there for Sutra Central.
Okay, so Sutra Central.
Would you mind share?
Okay, so Sutra Central. Now... Sutta Central is a project that I've been working on. Been part of the project since we began in about 2004, I think we began. But in the last year or two, we've really picked up a lot more momentum and been putting a lot more energy into it. So essentially, it's a sutta website, but it's unlike any other sutta website. There's plenty of places that you can read at least some of the suttas online. But what we do is we offer, I think, a far... We're trying to present a facility which will be offer the best of everything, the best translations, the best interface, the best way of using things, and as well as we don't just offer the translations, we also offer all the original texts. And it's the only digital project of any kind, as far as I'm aware, that systematically unites all of the original texts from all the different languages. Okay, so we have a database that has many thousands, I think probably close to 20,000 or something like that, links and connections between Buddhist suttas and passages in different places. So connections between the Pali texts and Chinese texts and Tibetan texts and Sanskrit texts and so on. And so we have all the original texts. We have the connections, the relationships between them, as well as translations and also various tools and so on that can help you to read them and to understand them. So this is very much a work in progress. We're working very hard and there's a lot of different aspects of it moving forward. But we want to provide a facility that's going to help people to realize to read the Buddha's words and to understand the Buddha's words. I have felt in the past couple of years, I've looked around in the digital realm. And I've tried to download some apps and look at some websites and see what people are doing in terms of the Buddha's texts. And frankly, I don't think there's very much that's very good. Most of the websites are, very poorly designed. They're very old-fashioned. And it's shocking. To me, it's shocking and embarrassing that we don't have our sacred scriptures freely available on the internet. It's ridiculous. If you want to read the Bible, of course you can read the Bible. There's hundreds of people that are giving away the Bible and so on. Right? There's one of the most popular Bible apps in, I think it's called YouBible or something like that, and they've been downloaded, I think, 200 million times or something like that. Okay, and you can read the Bible in 500 languages on it. Right? Buddha's, you can't read the Buddha scriptures even in one language. Right? Right? There's no complete collection of Buddha scriptures, early Buddha scriptures, that's available in any language in a modern translation. Okay, parts of them have been. Most of the Pali texts have been. Hardly any of the Chinese have been. Although some of my friends, Venerable Analio and Rod Bucknell, are just working on the translation of the Madhyama Agama. It's the first time ever that a major collection of early Buddhist texts from the Chinese has been translated into English. This is embarrassing. We've known about these things for 150 years, and they're still almost completely unknown. And so, for the first time, this period we're living in, I think, is very exciting because we're bringing these things out and making them available. And I would like to make them available not just for people who speak English. Right? What about if you speak Swahili? Right? You should be able to read the suttas, shouldn't you? Yeah. So I've got an African friend in Perth. I said, look, you should start translating into Swahili. He said, okay, I'll think about it. So we haven't got everything yet, but we should have, yeah? What about Portuguese? Yeah? What about Russian? Yeah? What about all these other things? Well, imagine if you're growing up in those environments. It's not that you don't need the Dhamma. Everybody needs the Dhamma. Everybody suffers, right? And so how do you get access to it? How do you get access to the Dhamma? And at the moment, I think Buddhists, you know, are so very insular in the way that we do things. And we really haven't had that metta to look outside our own communities and start to think, well, how can we make it available? It's not about trying to convert people, right? It's not trying to make people Buddhists. It's trying to give them something, some wisdom, so that we can help them with their suffering. Yeah, that's all. So this is gradually, little bit by little bit, we're putting it together. And we'll be developing it, and hopefully over the years we'll start by gathering different translations in different languages and so on, and then see, well, what can we do in terms of sponsoring new translations, bringing it into different languages, looking at crowdsourcing, developing web interfaces and different kinds of things that's going to help us to put this together and to develop it into something that's going to be really available and really useful for many people around the world. So this is what we're trying to do with Sutta Central. And so any donations you give will be a contribution to doing that.
Because of time, I know I think some of the brothers and sisters here will still like to ask questions, but Ajahn will still have to have his lunch. Okay, because as you know that for the monastic rule, they have to have lunch before 1 p.m. for the Singapore time. Okay, so shall we give a bit of metta to Ajahn for him to enjoy his lunch? So you can continue to give us talk in the next time, okay? Shall we say sadhu 3 times?
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu.